welcome to another exciting episode of Critical Reads, the podcast. I am your host, Neff. This is a show that is designed to help people critically analyze topics like race, culture, faith, amongst other things, one resource at a time. So if you are familiar with the show, welcome back. For those of you who are newer to the show, welcome. I hope you enjoy what we talk about today and are willing to listen to more episodes. For those of you who are returning, I know it's a little weird this week because I am kind of doing some editing with the intro. So I'm kind of adjusting and changing some things up. I hope it doesn't come off too weird, but I will reveal more to come of that, why that has changed a bit, with the wonderful surprise that I have coming soon. But outside of that, welcome. And I do hope that you guys enjoy today's episode, which is going to be the last book that we're doing for this month of May for Mental Health Awareness Month. I'm super excited about this book. The book is entitled The Unapologetic Guide to Black Mental Health. This book was created by an author named Rashida Walker, and she is someone that I didn't really know much about until I picked up this book and decided that I would like to cover this topic and just read it in general. So I am excited to talk about my experiences of reading this book and also hopefully opening you all to a new resource that might be helpful for you in the future. First off, I would like to note that I know that for this book, it is really centered on Black mental health. I do think that every race, every background struggles with mental health issues at some points in their lives, whether it's, you know, depression or anxiety because of a situation that has happened, or it could be a clinical situation going on. But I specifically wanted to focus on Black mental health because I know in our community, it's something that we don't typically talk about. And especially since I happen to be a Black woman, this is a topic that's very near and dear to me. And so whatever I can do to help increase awareness and increase knowledge and increase conversations about mental health in the Black community, I really, really want to do that. I think even in light of a lot of the things that we've witnessed as a Black community the past few years, from, you know, the endless shootings that we've seen by cop that we've had to keep watching over and over and over, and the hashtags, to even more recently, you know, there's been videos circulating around about P. Diddy and what happened with him and Cassie and things like that. So I think constantly on a loop, we as a community face a lot of different triggers where we are reminded of just the hardship sometimes of what it looks like to be Black in this country, even around the world. I know right now, even as I'm speaking, there's all these different genocides and unrest and different things going on. I know specifically a lot of the conversation has been with Palestine. I know there's Black people over there too, but I know that's particular to people who happen to be Middle Eastern. But I know there's also things going on in Africa and different countries there. So there's just, and also for me, I should say to Haiti, as a person whose family is from Haiti, I know there's a lot of unrest that's been going on there for years. So like I said, in general, I'm focusing on Black mental health in this particular book and topic and resource, but I think this is something that's a very important topic for every race, especially races that happen to be people of color, where there are different levels of oppression that we're all having to deal with, we're all having to face every day. And then at the same time, we have to create that space to be present for our families, be present for our friends, go to work in some cases, or if you don't have a job, figuring out how to survive and work through or live through like poverty, like things I can't even imagine. And so I do think it is so, so, so important for all of us to be mindful of where our mental health is and what we can do to address the issues that are there. And so I think whether you are Black or not, there are some nuggets in this book that everybody can relate to. But I will say, I would encourage, if you do read this book or you don't read this book, just the topics that I talk about tonight, or today rather, I would like you all to look for resources that are specific to your race as well, if you don't happen to be Black, just so that you can learn a little bit more specifically to what your experiences are. Because I know for me, this book ended up being very, very, very helpful with addressing some of the specific things that were affecting me as a Black woman. And so that is something that I encourage for everybody across the board as a person that wants to work on their mental health. So with that said, let me get off my little soapbox and let's start by introducing the author in the book. So first, the book, like I said, this is called The Unapologetic Guide to Black Mental Health. The intro that the publishers have for this book goes like this: an unapologetic exploration of the Black mental health crisis and a comprehensive roadmap to getting the care you deserve in an unequal system. We can't deny it any longer. There is a Black mental health crisis in our world today. Black people die disproportionately high rates due to chronic illness, suffer from poverty, undereducation, and the effects of racism. This book is an exploration of Black mental health in today's world, the forces that have undermined mental health progress for African Americans, and what needs to happen for African Americans to heal psychological distress, find community, and undo years of stigma and marginalization in order to access effective mental health care. In The Unapologetic Guide to Black Mental Health, psychologist and African American mental health expert Rita Walker offers important information on the mental health crisis in the Black community, how to combat stigma, spot potential mental illness, how to practice emotional wellness, and how to get the best care in a system steeped in racial bias. This book will help you recognize mental and emotional health problems, understand the myriad ways in which these problems impact overall health and quality of life and relationships, develop psychological tools to neutralize ongoing stressors, and live more fully, and navigate a mental health care system that is unequal. It's past time to take Black mental health seriously, whether you suffer yourself, have a loved one who needs help, or are a mental health professional working with the Black community. This book is an essential and much needed resource. Okay, so that was the about the book. Now, I'm going to share a little bit about the author. So I got this from the About Me section, but I'm sure by this point she's probably done way more, but I'll just give a brief little overview of some of the things she has done. So Rita Walker, PhD, is a tenured professor of psychology in the Department of Psychology at the University of Houston. She is a behavioral science researcher and licensed psychologist who has published more than 50 scientific papers on African American adult mental health, suicide, and resilience. Walker is recognized as a fellow in the American Psychological Association due to her scholarly accomplishments. Walker has been a guest expert psychologist to T.D. Jakes' national television talk show, and her work has appeared or has been cited in the Washington Post, CNN Health, the Houston Chronicle, and Ebony Magazine. Her expertise has been critical to mentoring doctoral students in cross-cultural psychology since 2003. Walker was previously a lead consultant in the statewide African American faith-based education and awareness initiative in Texas. She conducts workshops and coordinates with churches and other organizations to address emotional wellness. Now, first, I would not be me if I did not acknowledge, yes, I know there was some association with TD Jakes, and there has been a lot of things that has come out about him that have been very unfortunate, cringy, and gross, and a lot of different adjectives. So I will acknowledge that. Second, I will acknowledge that there is a spiritual component to this book, and that Miss Walker, or Dr. Walker, does have a background in religion. She talks about a lot about how she identifies with the Christian faith, and she does use some of that in the book. For those who are African American, or just who in general are not necessarily aligning with the Christian faith, I like to acknowledge that piece, just because I do think, regardless of where you are with your faith, we are spiritual beings in general. So I do think the parts of this book where she does bring up spirituality, I do think that part is still important, whether you are Christian, Muslim, atheist, you have whatever background. I do think there is a part of you that will still kind of have to address some of the spiritual parts, because I do think we are spiritual beings at the end of the day. So whatever that ends up looking for you, that's up to you. I'm not here to tell you how to tap into your spiritual side, but I did want to just acknowledge that piece, because I do recognize, like, everybody comes from a different background. I know for me, I happen to identify as a Christian, so does Dr. Walker, but for everybody else, that might look different. And even then, I know for me, as a Christian, that has looked very weird or different compared to others, and that's something I've noticed and recognized as well. So I am very aware, and I acknowledge that those differences exist. So briefly, I'm going to talk a little bit about what helped me pick this book, or what made me pick this book, and what it covers. So obviously, like I said, it covers Black mental health. I ended up picking this book because it was suggested to me on, I think my Audible was like, hey, this might be an interesting book. And in general, I know for me, I really enjoy just learning about different resources, reading different things, not just for myself, but just in case I have a patient or somebody that I'm like, oh, this might be a really good resource for them. So I was excited to pick up this book, read it. And I love that, because for me, my first love was psychology. So I love that this author, Dr. Walker, does have a background in psychology. And to hear that she is one of the people that does a lot of research with the African American community, or people that identify as Black or in the African diaspora, she does a lot of work with them. So I thought that was very cool and very much needed, because I know she does even bring up in the book that a lot of the work of research in psychology, and actually almost every field, is very highly centered to the white perspective a lot of the times. It heavily leans that way. So a lot of the times when we do look up research, or we do look up statistics or certain things, it really skews that way. So I know for me as a social worker, there's a lot of cool theories and things that I've learned that I'm like, oh, this could be great to apply to one of my patients. But I also have to think about, from a multicultural lens, like, how can I apply this to somebody that is Black, or that is Hispanic, that is, you name it, right? Because a lot of those studies tend to be done with, like, white middle-class people, for example. And that experience is so different compared to everybody else, right? So that's just something that I immediately thought was really cool. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about the thesis of this book, and this is just a little bit of how she breaks it down. I think similar to the past few that I've done, I'm trying my best to not give away all the nuggets, because I do think this book is really good, and I do want you to read it, whether you get it from the library, audiobook, whatever you do. But the main thesis here is that she acknowledges that there is a high risk of suicide that has been happening in our community. And so this is partially why she's like, hey, I really, really want to address this. So I know in the beginning of the book, she says the following: there is probably hundreds of unapologetic guides for mental health, for white mental health, sorry. Though they are not likely to be titled that, the content of these publications betrays the implied idea that mental health is the same regardless of race. This book boldly and courageously challenges that assumption and speaks directly to Black people about unique issues that affect their mental health. So right off the bat, I really did like this intro because I do, like I said, a lot of the research, a lot of different things tend to skew a particular way, especially for white mental health. And so it's nice that she names that and she's like, hey, I want to try to tackle the specific things that affect our community. And so the way that she does this is first in chapter one, she kind of talks about how the psychological crisis is real, which I'll come back to. But she challenges, like, I know a lot of the times, like for Black people, we're very big on like keeping things a secret, keeping it in the family. We have to be strong, all these different things. But she is kind of like ringing the alarm, like, hey, there's something going on here. We need to do something different, right? And then from chapter two, it begins the two sections that she has. So part one is recognize the serious threats to emotional health and life. That's part one of the book where she has chapters two through six kind of in that bubble. And then in part two, she covers reclaim your mind to reclaim a life worth living. And that is where she puts in chapters 7 through 11. And so, like I said, very quickly, I'll go through some of the chapters. So chapter 2, she talks a little bit more about suicide, something that is typically hard to talk about in our community. And so she gives some language about that, just explaining what's going on with suicide, ways to support, what does it mean when somebody's having suicidal ideation or suicidal thoughts? What does it look like if they actually have a plan or intent? How can you support that? Again, I'll go a little bit more into this chapter in a bit, but I really enjoyed in general this chapter because I know suicide is often a very difficult topic to talk about just in general. So she tries her best to kind of break down some of those barriers. And then in chapter three, she talks about this idea of low-key suicide, which was interesting. So this idea is basically decisions that can lead to premature death. So this might look like you neglecting your mental health, neglecting your physical health, suicide by another hand. So I know she talks a little bit about suicide by cop, which is a tough one. Suicide by alcohol and drugs. This may look like somebody that knows that they have, or they may not know, but they have an idea that they're depending very heavily on drugs and alcohol to cope. And instead of going out and getting the help that they need, they just continue to use, and that eventually leads to death. And the last one is the unnecessary struggle, which I like that she brings this topic up because I think a lot of times in the Black community, there's this idea that we have to like struggle, and struggle is part of our DNA. And if we're not doing that, like, are we really Black and all this stuff? And it's like, no, like, we don't have to have this. And again, I'll talk about this a little bit more, but I love that she puts that as an idea of like, these are things that low key can lead to premature death, but we're not addressing because we're so busy keeping up with the Joneses and trying to have a particular appearance that we neglect our needs and our mental health. Chapter four, she talks a little bit about ways that we need to recognize depression and anxiety, especially when they get out of hand. So she does talk a little bit about how, in general, people can deal with some depression and anxiety symptoms in general. And sometimes they're not necessarily debilitating, but they're just there, especially she acknowledges, like, for example, just being Black in general can cause anxiety. I know, for example, I can go to a grocery store or a store in general, and there can be some anxiety for me as a Black woman walking in and being worried that somebody might think I'm stealing or they might follow me or different things like that. So there are some things about being Black that can cause anxiety. But aside of that, recognizing that there are times where our anxiety and depression get so bad that we cannot function and we need to address those things. So she kind of highlights some of the situations where that may be happening and it might be a good time to get some extra help to address those issues. Okay, so then we get to chapter 5, and chapter 5 basically highlights the elephant in the room, racism. And I love that she kind of titles this part, "Racism is bad for you." So I kind of chuckle because it's like, yeah, who would think that this is good for us? But here in this chapter, she talks a lot more about how racism can affect your overall well-being. And she also even talks about how research and data is not always as up to date as it should be when it comes to understanding the Black experience. So again, back to that research piece where she's coming from her background, she's recognizing and acknowledging and saying to us, like, hey, research data, all this stuff is not really understanding the roles that racism has in our lives, but they do have a role, and it's important for us to pay attention to that for us to work on our mental health. So I thought that was an awesome chapter to talk about, because I know racism, depending on who you are as a Black person, I know some people don't acknowledge it sometimes, which is interesting to me, but hey, do you? And then for the rest of us who acknowledge it, just having to be aware of, like, how it can show up and how it impacts us and all these different things can be very difficult at times. So I love that she created space to just acknowledge it and say, hey, this is something that affects us and we should talk about it. Chapter 6, she talks a little bit more about assimilating and internalized racism. I think that this is such a great chapter because I know for me, as a person that has been in predominantly white spaces my whole life, this chapter really spoke to me because I know that even though I am really good with being a chameleon and being around different cultures and different things like that, especially with white people, it can be a challenge sometimes as well. So I love that she created space for this in this book and just be giving an honest look at what it can feel like. So this is another chapter I might come back to and talk a little bit about more of what stuck out to me, but in general, this was an interesting chapter. And then after she's kind of went through these different topics and what affect us, this is where she enters part 2, where she talks about reclaiming your mind to reclaim a life worth living. And so in chapter 7, she explores and talks about what does it look like to explore and expand our ideas of Blackness so that it's meaningful to us, right? So this is another chapter that I really, really enjoyed. But here she talks about, like, what does it look like to have a positive connection with Black identity? What are ways that we can connect with our culture? And so from there, she goes into chapter 8, where she talks about making the most of our spiritual resourcefulness. So here she talks a little bit about spirituality and religiosity and how that is a big part of being Black or what it means to be Black. And again, I know, and like I said in the beginning, she does focus here on the experience of the church, the Black church in particular, and how the Black church has played such a huge role in the United States of, like, carrying on traditions and all the things like that. But I did think this chapter was also very cool because it does also hint to whether you're identifying with any other religion as a Black person, especially like, let's look at the history of Africa, for example. There were so many different religions and different things that kind of came from that continent within the different cultures in Africa. And just so acknowledging that our ancestors were religious, they were spiritual, whether or not Western ideas agree with their holiness, or I don't know. I know there's a lot of, especially from the Western side, there's a lot of demeaning the Black religions that are not Christianity and automatically saying, oh, this is completely demonic and all this stuff. But meanwhile, we're like learning about Greek mythology and stuff, right? I know that was my experience in high school. So this idea that we are religious and we are spiritual, whether it is, again, identifying with the Christian faith or not, I think is such an important part of our Black experience. I do think, and even like we look at how the drums that we usually use in our songs and different things and beats and different things like that, that was something that was passed on from Africa to us, right? So there's a sense of community and all these different things that come from our spiritualness. And obviously there's so much research that could be done on this. So I'm not like a subject matter expert, but I know as I've connected more with learning about African culture and just what it looks like to be Black, that's something that I have noticed and I thought has been really cool. So I like that she does at least acknowledge like, hey, we are spiritual as a group. We are religious as a group. And but I'm also acknowledging that that can look different for different types of Black people as well. So from there, she talks a little bit about in chapter 9, what does it look like to be genuine about needing help? And then also recognizing that when we do that, it creates space for getting help when it's possible. So here she challenges us to re-envision what it means to get help, and not looking at it as a bad thing. And then also being able to stop and recognize when the tools that we're using to get help are helpful or not helpful for real. Because there are maybe some things that we're like, oh, this is helpful, but the reality is it's not. And so taking some time to really dissect what does helpful look like and when do we actually have to make some adjustments for things that are not necessarily helpful. Okay, and so in chapter 10, she talks a little bit about how to make therapy work when you actually need it. And so here she acknowledges that there could be a point where the tools that you are using are not working and you might need some outside help. So she helps you kind of navigate and think through what those moments may look like for you or your family member. And then she kind of tackles some common misconceptions about therapies and what are some expectations about therapy. So I particularly enjoyed this chapter because it's different from the book that I did recently about Are You Okay? Where she kind of went through all the different types of practitioners and different things that you may need. And so even though that book was such a great resource, Dr. Morton, I felt like she tackles it from like a general perspective. So she really helps you think about it in general, which is great. But with this book, the way that I saw it being a little bit different is it does really focus on some of the concerns and the fears and the things that we have as a Black person in general. So for example, like I know when I first started therapy and stuff, there is that fear of like, you know, we typically don't talk about things outside of the home. What can this, like, how can this be used? So she tackles that, for example. She also tackles the realities that when you are talking to a therapist, especially if you have to talk to one that's white, what are some things that you can look out for? What are some things that might be a challenge with working with the white person? What are some things that may be helpful with working with one? And just helping you be aware and acknowledge when you need to advocate for yourself, for an example. So if you are working with somebody that's white, for example, and it works and you're finding that it's helpful, great. But if it's not, how do you advocate for yourself? So these are some things that I really loved in this chapter because she was very specific to the things that may make us hesitant to go to therapy as a Black person. And then lastly, chapter 11, she talks a little bit about what does it look like to apply new and improved tools to overcome stress. So here she talks a little bit about after you've gone to therapy, after you're learning how to apply some of these new tools or what it looks like to apply some of these new tools, how can you actually do that in your day to day? And so again, this is going to be probably another section that I focus on a little bit more, but I did enjoy this chapter too, because she tries to give you some practical steps that you can apply so that you can hopefully enhance your mental health and actually keep that change that you've made, even if you may have some setbacks here and there. All right, so now that I've talked about some of the chapters, I wanted to focus a little bit more on some of the things that stood out to me. First, I will say in the beginning, I liked in chapter one how she really lays a case for why she wrote this book. And one of the things that really, really stood out to me was this idea of suicide wasn't supposed to be a part of our culture. And here she kind of talks about how a lot of the messaging that would come from pastors for a while was that suicide was mainly a white thing. But the reality was there was starting to be a shift in our culture where that she was noticing, like, there's a lot of increases of suicidality. And so that has been something that she was like, hey, we need to sound the alarm and pay attention to this, because even though this is a common message, this is not the case. And so I thought this was really interesting because of the reason people were saying that suicide is mainly a white thing was because she was noting that Black people usually are known to be resilient, and because of their history of struggle and making a way despite of, you know, all the different things that have been thrown at us politically, economically, and socially, you know, this is something that, again, we just typically don't see in our community. And so even though in some cases, I know for me, I was like, yeah, I can see that. Like, we have, if you look at Black history, like, I know for me, the little that I've been reading, I know there's so much more, but the stuff I've been reading, like, it's wild to me to think about how my ancestors have put up and done so much, given all the shit that they've had to go through. But at the same time, like, I'm always constantly in a state of like, why? Like, why do we have to go through this? Or why did we? And the fact that resilience is something that is known in our community, obviously, yes, there's a sense of pride in that, but also there's a sense of grief and sadness that that even has to be a part of our identity, right? And so I love that she acknowledges that because of this reality that we're resilient, that suicide isn't for us and all these different things, it kind of drives conversations about anxiety, depression, and any other mental health need, especially suicidality, like underground, because we don't want to talk about it because we don't want to appear like that we're not Black or that we're not resilient or you name it, right? And so I really love that she took the time to call this out, especially when she notes that in 2016, studies indicated that the suicide rate among 5 to 11-year-old African-American Black children had exceeded that of their same-age European-American/white peers. So she like calls out like, hey, even though the common knowledge or the common perception is that we don't do this, the stats, the data, the research is clearly showing the opposite. And so because of that, we have to do something different. We can't continue to ignore this. And so I know for me, when I first read this book, because I've read it again for the podcast, but when I first read this book, I was just flabbergasted that, you know, people that young, or just Black people in general, were doing this, but people that young especially were doing this. And so I think in general, I think about how much we're not doing for our young people and our kids, and it always breaks my heart to see like the world that we're living, leaving them behind. And I know there's always like a push to have kids and blah, blah, blah now. And I'm just like, for what? Like, if this is the place that they're in where things are so bad, where like they're having these urges, like, I'm like, we could do better, right? And so I like, again, that she brings this up. And so she encourages this idea of building psychological fortitude. And I like that she uses this term, because instead of her going to, hey, go deal with your mental health, go to your mental illness, go to, like, instead of using terms that may be a little scarier to people, I like that she uses this term and she equates it, or like she compares it to using SPF when you have to go outside and deal with the sun, right? So she said, build this up. And so mental fortitude and mental toughness or psychological fortitude, this is basically an idea of resilience. But also this idea of resilience allows us to endure, persevere, and do all these things through tough situations, but in a way that doesn't ignore what's going on, but helps you acknowledge what's going on while also protecting your mind. So it's not saying, hey, let's ignore discrimination, let's ignore this, let's ignore that. It's saying those things are here, those things are present, unfortunately, but how can we both acknowledge that those things are here, but also build up ways to help us get through that? And I know in therapy speak, this is something that is referred to as protective factors. So that may look like your faith, building community, connecting with your African American ancestry. This may also look like connecting with mental health services, going to therapy, being on medication, even though that can be very scary for a lot of us. All these different pieces are available and are needed so that you can feel a lot more strong when it comes to dealing with the day-to-day things. And so I love that she brings that up, and she kind of, again, reframes what it looks like to get help and to build fortitude to deal with day-to-day stuff. Because the reality is, you know, being Black sometimes is hard. And as much as we don't want to stop and acknowledge it sometimes, and we're just trying to push through, because I know even with myself, if I stop too long and think through how hard it is to be Black sometimes, or the things that we have to experience as Black people sometimes, like, it just brings me into a really sad, dark place. So I like, again, that she's like, hey, we can create space to acknowledge this, but at the same time, create ways to work through this and deal with this in a way that's healthy for us and doesn't negate the ways that we are experiencing or being impacted by day-to-day stuff. So after this part, one of the things that I did like that she brings up in this book was the idea of a necessary struggle. And this is a thing that she talks about in chapter 3, where she talks about low-key suicide. This section really spoke to me because she does talk a lot about how a lot of the times we will ignore our need, and instead we will put in things like, advancing in my career is very important, or let me keep buying unaffordable shoes or handbags, or go to social events and continue to push my credit card to a place where I don't have any control of my debt now, and I have to keep working hard to just pay that off, or pursue maybe compliments and admiration from others that aren't very needed, right? And so I like that she challenges that a bit, because I know from my experiences, even, this is something that I would even witness in my family. As much as they have really great qualities, they also are people that they were just very big on the American dream. So my parents would always be working very hard, multiple jobs, trying to kind of keep up with the Joneses and all these different things. And I cannot say that I didn't appreciate the hard work that they put in, given the background that we came from. And, you know, they afforded me and my sister the opportunity to go to private school and go to college and different things. So I'm not poo-pooing on that end of it. I get that some of these sacrifices, they did it with us in mind. However, even now, as we are older, I recognize with my family, like, they're still kind of in that hustle culture. They're still trying to keep up with the Joneses and have a certain appearance. And because they're doing that, they're not creating space for themselves to focus on their mental health and their wellness. And that's something that is across the board with, like, most of my family. And so I like that she brings this up for us, because I do think a lot of us will want to kind of appear or appeal to the white gaze and have these ideas of power and wealth and all these different things where, A, they're sometimes kind of unattainable, because I personally am like, the system isn't necessarily built for us. So sometimes it can be unattainable for real. But also, it comes at the cost of us really experiencing authentic community, being connected with our families, being connected with our churches, being connected with, you know, a whole lot of things that might actually give us more life rather than us working so hard that our health and our everything and our even our families are in jeopardy, right? So I like that she challenges that a little bit. And for me, that even brought me to the next point that I enjoyed, where she talks about assimilating and how a lot of the times that can also kind of add to this unnecessary struggle. At least for me, that's how I felt. And so assimilating means taking on a culture that is not your own to avoid seeming threatening. And I know as African Americans, Black people, however you identify, that is something that happens a lot. I know we talk about sometimes code switching, even where we have to appear a certain way, especially in the midst of the white gaze. And then outside of that, we're a different way, right? And so because we're constantly going back and forth and doing that, it can be a challenge sometimes, because to some extent over time, you're recognizing there has to be a sacrifice of self and culture so that you can fit in. And I know for me, there was a point in my schooling where we had to do something about, I think it was about culture or cultural awareness or something like that. And it hit me one day during this that I was like, I cannot sit here like a lot of my white peers, and sometimes even some of my other non-Black peers, like I couldn't say like I genuinely know about my background because our family assimilated and we know nothing about, like, I know nothing about my Haitian culture, really. I don't really know much about my family. I know when I try to ask my family about their parents and different things, like, they don't really know. And that's a lot of it because, like, we've had to kind of take a step back from our cultures and our ideas from Haiti and kind of make it work in white society. And so I know for me, part of growing and learning and all these different pieces has been trying to figure out how to reconnect with my Black side a little bit more. And I will say, even adding the religious piece to this, I did grow up in a predominantly white space where I was going to white churches. So I know for a long time, part of my story was I felt like I had to choose between being Black and being a Christian, because a lot of the Christian upbringing and teachings and different things that I was surrounded by was mostly white. And so it was kind of like I was denouncing my Blackness, denouncing my Haitianness, denouncing all these different things to appeal to these white Christian people. And so that was something for me that I had to kind of figure out how to engage in a little bit more. And so eventually I was able to figure out what that looks like, which I will touch upon in a minute. But it was something that was very real to me that I had to figure out that, hey, I'm assimilating a lot. There's a lot of internalized racism here, especially I had to recognize, like, I had some fears around what does it look like to be around Black people, even because of the crap that I was learning as a kid. And so that was a huge, like, upheaval for me. And I'm glad that I went through that experience, because then I can understand other people that may have experienced what I've experienced, especially if they're immigrants, But it's also sad that that's the reality that a lot of us experience, especially as immigrants. So assimilating, that was a big one for me. And I think it was cool that she brought up the movie Get Out. I know a lot of Black people have seen that movie. It kills me every time, like, how accurate it is. Being around white people, being uncomfortable around them sometimes, having them, like kind of desire your talents and your accolades and different things. Because I know part of that movie is they, the white people were trying to get Black people that had some of the things that they wanted. So one Black guy had good eyesight with the main character, Chris, had good eyesight with him being able to take pictures. And one of the white men that was blind wanted those attributes. And that's why they brought him there, so that they can eventually take that over. Same thing with running and all these different things. So it was like this idea of like these white people kind of envy and want things from you. And they treat you a certain way. And the microaggressions and the racism in that movie were just too spot on. But then I also thought about this show that I loved on HBO by Issa Rae, Insecure, and how her experiences of her working in a nonprofit organization as the only Black woman there, and they're working with Black kids. And so you would think that they would go to her or listen to her. She'd be the voice that speaks up and like knows what to do to help that community a little bit more. But instead, the white people that she was working with, they would all like, you know, ignore her concerns. They would all try to explain to her what they thought was right to do, even though Issa sometimes had to be like, no, friends, like, this is not going to work. And then it would be funny because some of the episodes when something bad would happen in the organization, automatically she gets blamed for it, even though, like, you know, she was trying to sound the alarm and warn them like, hey, these are bad ideas. So that was wild to me. But I know for me as a Black person that does work in predominantly white spaces and works in social work and different things like that, I definitely saw a lot of that happen, unfortunately. And so I recognized a lot of the things that Issa experienced, and I was like, damn, like, this is so real. So those are two great, you know, it's a movie and a show that kind of highlight some of the realities of assimilating and dealing with internalized racism and things like that. So last thing that kind of stood out to me was, well, second and last thing that stood out to me was the idea of reclaiming your mind and figuring out what it looks like to reclaim a life worth living, especially with chapter 7, where she talks a little bit more about exploring and expanding meaningful Blackness. This, to me, was so powerful because this is something that has helped me so much. And she highlights here in this chapter, she says, my research shows that African Americans who do not see their Black selves in a positive way are at an increased risk for suicide. On the other hand, a positive connection to Black identity protects us to some degree through psychological buffers. When we have a buffer, bad things can happen, but they do not have as much of a negative effect on you compared to someone who does not have a buffer. And so this really spoke to me, especially when, I don't know, we look at every day and we're seeing all these hashtags, we're seeing all these people passing away from things that should not happen to our community. And just knowing that there are positive images that can kind of help challenge that, I've seen in my own life that that's also very helpful. So I will say, you know, for me, creating a positive connection to my Black identity has been so powerful. And I know she talks about, you know, how to reclaim ourselves as Africans, or how to reclaim our history, how to reclaim our hair and language, how to reclaim our culture beyond being American. So I know for me, as a person that's Haitian, how do I reclaim my culture beyond being American? How do we reclaim our stories? And so I know there was part of my growth in this area, especially, like I said, looking at, I'm always in these predominantly white spaces, but I'm Black and I feel like I have to choose, right? And so there was a point in my life where I was like, I don't want to do this. because the ideas of what is considered successful in this community do not really match with what I consider to be successful. And for example, for me, that was community. For me, that was being able to enjoy my job, to feel like I'm authentically myself. And a lot of the time, grind culture, American culture doesn't really breed that kind of stuff. So I had to kind of redefine for myself, what does it look like for me to be successful? What is successful for me? And in doing that, it also looked at me reclaiming my hair even. So I know one of my old friends, Danny, she had locks. And for a while I was like considering, what do I want to do with my hair? Because we have to do so much crap to like upkeep it if we're not doing it naturally a lot of the time. So not to bash anybody that does these extra things, but I know for me, sew-ins and just all this other upkeep to put in, like, you know, more fake hair and stuff, I couldn't keep doing that. Like, for me, my hair was like breaking left and right when I would try to do some of those things. And so for me, reconnecting with my blackness was trying to figure out a healthy relationship with my hair. And that kind of came along with me getting locks. And because I got locks, my hair has been natural. It's been growing. Like, sometimes I don't even take care of it probably as much as I should or can be. And my hair has been growing and blossoming like crazy. And so for me, I was very thankful. That was one small way that I was like, I am going to stop trying to assimilate in this way and try to have like what I guess it growing up felt like white people hair, and actually do what works for my hair. And again, I'm not saying that if you do want to get sew-ins and get braids and all these different things, not that any of that is bad, but I know for me, it was just getting too much. My hair was breaking like crazy. It wasn't authentic to me. Now that I have locks, I'm like, I can't believe I didn't do this sooner. And so that was one way I got to reconnect with myself. I know another way was just reconnecting with history in general. I think growing up, we are always taught, like, well, I was taught not to really pay attention to Black resources as much. I don't know why, because there's a lot of great things, but, well, racism, I know why. But I feel like growing up, when we did talk about Black things, Black music, Black culture, it wasn't celebrated as much. And so as I grew up and I learned more about Black culture, Black inventors, things that we've done over the past years, like that was another way for me to really connect with Black culture in a positive way. And so when people try to now put up disparaging images of Blackness, Black culture, and try to make me feel bad about being Black, I'm like, you know, fuck you, essentially. Like, I can now look and see, oh no, actually, we are great inventors. We are innovative. We are doing the damn thing. And not just in the past, but even in the present. And so even in the present, I'm mindful about following Black people that are doing really cool things. And it doesn't even have to be like you're, you know, big engineer and all this stuff, even like things like mothering. Like, I know I follow some Black parents on Instagram and different things, and it's been nice to just see like Black parents showing up for their kids on a day to day and even trying to practice gentle parenting and, you know, breaking generational curses, like things like that. So there's really cool things that we are doing as a Black community that don't get highlighted. Instead, it's like, oh, look, this Black family is broken again, or this person's going to jail, or this person is shooting, you know, in this neighborhood, or like all these negative images are just only put in our community. And so I know for me, it has been very healing to connect with the cool things we're doing as well, because the reality is every single culture deals with negative stuff. Every single culture has people struggling with domestic violence. Every single culture has people dealing with poverty. Every single culture has people that are doing things that are embarrassing to their culture. But for some reason, a lot of the times it just gets hyper-focused on Black people, and that's wild to me, but again, racism. So I, again, am very mindful of like, how can I also incorporate a lot of holistic healing images of Blackness so that I can kind of counteract the other things that I see, right? And so I think that's something that is an ongoing practice. But I do like that she talks about us learning how to create ways to do this. So she brings up creating traditions with our people, taking cultural vacations, so going to different spots of the world and connecting with the diaspora through those vacations. So for example, I know there was a time I went to Atlanta and just connecting with the MLK Center and seeing all the things that MLK did, that was actually very healing for me. And so that could be something that you can do that's smaller, and you don't have to go all the way to Africa and find a country, right? In case you can't go there. And I know, for example, in Chicago, they had like an African American museum. I know they also have that in Washington, D.C., right? So obviously, I know there's some parts of those museums that are kind of rough too, because they're highlighting the other stuff that's happened. But it's also nice to be able to just see like, okay, look at the cool things that we've also done in spite of this, right? And then my favorite line that she has in this chapter is basically she challenges us to dream bigger than the American dream. And that to me, I was like, yes, girl, because I know for me and my family who have immigrated here, as much as I can see why my family was drawn to the American dream, given all the things that were going on in Haiti, I have also seen how the American dream can be very toxic and hurtful for my family as well. And so I think taking an honest view about some of the things that the American dream has contributed to that are not so healthy is such a big part of deconstructing or critically analyzing the world around us. And just taking that time to do that, and not just doing that, but taking a step further and taking actions to challenge that and do something different is great. And so again, I know for me, like I said, that looked like me redefining what success looks like for me, and not in the American terms, but in my terms. And then staying true to that has been so healing. And so again, that doesn't look like me getting all these accolades because I'm writing all these papers, or I don't know, like I'm making all this money as a therapist. For me, it's look like, how am I authentically showing as myself so I can help my clients show up as their selves? How am I, you know, fostering good relationships with people that I love and care about, that's helping them reach their goals, reach their potential? How am I being a bridge builder? So even with a podcast like this, like how can I make opportunities to be a bridge builder and help other people experience freedom in their own lives, in their own spaces, in their own communities? And again, those things are not always easy, but I find like doing those things make me feel a lot better than trying to pursue the wealth and power that this country promises, that is ultimately a load of bullshit a lot of the times. So that for me has been, again, very freeing to be able to take those steps and to actually find ways to follow through with them. And of course, like it's not perfect, like there's still a lot of work in progress, but again, I'm trying to figure out how to dream bigger and do different things so that I'm not getting caught into these generational cycles of really bad depression, really bad anxiety, and just, again, killing myself slowly because I'm pursuing things that are not to my betterment, and even to the betterment of my family. And then I guess the last thing I wanted to point out that she says, she, at the end of the book, talks about calling in Black. And I love this. And this is in chapter 11, where she talks about how to apply the new and improved tools that you've learned to overcome stress. I love this idea that she has about calling in Black, because one of the things I notice within my family structure is that everybody is very hardworking, which is not bad, but it's to the point where like they have like thousands of hours probably of vacation days that they just never take. They're always working, they're always grinding. And the only time my family members a lot of times take a break is when they're sick or when they're in the hospital or they're not doing well. And so I like that she challenges, like, take your vacation days, be mindful of that, and don't be feeling like you need to make an excuse to take care of your well-being. And I know one of the ways she thinks about this or challenges this idea is she talks about how a lot of the times, because of racism, we're watching all these shootings and different things happen, and we're having to see these hashtags, and people are playing these tapes over and over and over of, you know, people getting shot by the police. And so she highlights here that a lot of times, like, after we're experiencing that and we're having to go to work, and especially if you're in a predominantly white space, it's hard sometimes to be like, oh, actually, I need to take some time off. But she's encouraging, like, take it. Like, if you have the time and you're like, I just watched this, I need to call out today, do that. And even then, like, don't use only those situations to take time off. Because if there's times where, like, things are going on with your family or just in general, you're like, I just need a break. Like, don't feel that you have to continue to hustle and not take those times off. And so I know for me, that's something that I am challenging myself to do a little bit more, is like, I'm like, the bills will always be there. Uncle Sam will always be breathing down my neck. But being very intentional about taking days off, taking time off, and just being able to enjoy, whether it's my friends, a trip, or just being in the house all day and eating shit and, like, not doing anything, that's okay. Like, I don't have to feel like I have to keep grinding just for the sake of grinding and doing something. And so I like that she normalizes that a little bit, or she's trying to normalize that. I know there's other people that are doing this as well. I follow this person on Instagram, for example, called the Nat Ministry. And one of the things that she encourages is, like, sometimes you just need to have time to rest. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I know one of the things she brings up is, like, rest being a form of resistance. I love that, because I do think, again, part of American culture, part of white supremacy, part of capitalism, part of our structure in this society is, if you're not working, if you're not, you know, working yourself to death, there's something wrong with you, which is wild. Especially when we spout these ideas that we're a Christian nation and God talks about resting in the Bible, and we still don't do that. That's wild to me. And I know something I've even been realizing. So I've officially left the hospital job I've mentioned before. I've officially left the treatment job that I was at recently as well. And so, like, those, both of those jobs, they had me so stressed. I was, like, grinding my teeth. It was a badge of honor to be staying late, especially, and even at the hospital, like, sometimes there was, like, this clock out and finish your work mentality, even though it's like you're not getting paid for it. But those are seen as, like, good things. In a treatment center, I was salary, but it was seen as a good thing sometimes to be like, oh yeah, I went to the coffee shop and I finished doing my notes. It's like, no, like, the fact that we are at a place where, like, you can't even rest because there's just so much put upon you. And there's that expectation that you're going to keep doing all that stuff that's put upon you, even though it's your weekend and you should be resting. That's wild to me. And so I love that this book is, like, challenging that. And I also love, like, now in my new role, which is nice, but also weird sometimes, but, like, they encourage us to take time off. They're encouraging us to have a work-life balance. And I remember multiple times the past few weeks as I've been processing this new job, there's times where I'm just like, is it okay for me to enjoy this? Like, it's weird that I'm not this busy. Or it's weird that they're being this nice to me. And to me, it's like, it's sad that that is not the reality of most of our jobs. That us taking time off is looked upon as, like, there's something wrong with us, that this isn't okay, like, all this stuff. And so, I don't know, I want that to be a challenge to all of us. Like, I understand, you know, not everybody can do what I did and just leave a job and things like that. So I'm not saying that you have to leave your job. But what I'm saying is, whether you can leave or not, just being intentional about resting, being intentional about caring for yourself, and being intentional of not letting it get to the point where things are really, really bad with your health or really, really bad with your mental health for you to be able to say, hey, I need to do something different. You know, making that choice to do something different before it gets to that point. And so with that said, I thought today to end this episode with some of the things that I kind of do now for self-care. And this list is growing and changing as my life grows and changes. But I will say that this book has been a challenge for me to kind of continue to practice taking care of myself and not waiting until things get really bad with my mental health, especially as a Black woman, to, you know, take care of my mental health. And so I'm hoping that as you guys engage with this podcast today and hear some of my ideas and different things like that, it can challenge you to do some things a little differently too. Because like I said, I think the earlier we make these changes and the earlier we are proactive with just what we let in our headspace or what we let in our space in general, the better it is for us overall. So here are some of the things that I do for my self-care. So the first one is always pretty funny because as much as I very much enjoy engaging with Black content, I think there are parts of Black content that can be really tough for me, especially because I'm a person that loves learning about our history. And there's parts of our history that's very steeped in racism and very sad. And so one of the things I've had to learn that I needed to do for self-care is I'll watch very cheesy movies, especially Hallmark ones. And sometimes it'll definitely have to be the ones with white people in it, because I have found that those books that I've read that are very hard and difficult to read, it really makes it hard for me to be in white spaces sometimes. So by watching Hallmark movies and those cheesy movies, it helps me kind of remind myself of, okay, yes, these people have the capacity to do this evil shit, but also they're also human. They're also, you know, trying to seek out love, validation, affection, all these different things like I am, but, you know, life, racism, we're broken, right? So that has helped me. I know for other people, it could be different. Watching white content may not help that, but for me, it has helped me. So that's one of the things I do for self-care. I can't explain why it helps, but it does. The next thing that I do sometimes is I'll read books for fun. So I did put in my notes, read smut, but other fun books. So sometimes since I'm a hopeless romantic, for me, I do like reading romantic books. Sometimes they do end up being more smutty, but here we are. But I do enjoy reading romantic books, just reading books and for fun in general. And so with this too, it's been nice because I've even been introduced to a lot of cool Black authors that I've liked and enjoyed. So it's nice to kind of dabble into different things. So I know sometimes I'll read like mystery. I'm not really too big into fantasy and sci-fi, but here and there I'll dabble in it. Like I know I even read recently Dorothy Must Die, and you know, that's not always like a genre that I'm in, but I actually enjoyed it, right? So that has helped. Working out, I will say initially, I was like, I don't understand why people like working out. I don't get it. It doesn't make me feel great, all this stuff. But then I met a friend in my previous job that we ended up doing 75 hard, but like a soft version of it. And after the 75 days, I was like, wow, I really enjoy this. And I started noticing a difference in my mood, difference in how I felt about my body, different things like that. So it doesn't have to be that intense, even if it's like, I know for before I did 75 hard, I just started with like walking 30 minutes a day or walking an hour a day sometimes if I had the time, or an hour and a half, whatever. But just taking some time to connect with your body and that way move your body can be very helpful and freeing and help you feel good about yourself, I feel like. And I've even sometimes I'll see them as like mindfulness walks. So if I had like a really long day, I'm like, hey, I'm going to go outside. I'm going to walk around for a little bit and this will help me, right? So that's helpful. Another thing, limit social media. So again, we see so much tragedy in our world that's been happening. I mean, throw a rock, something's happening, right? So I will say, yes, it's important to be informed, but I also am very mindful of like not oversaturating myself with things that will, you know, make things harder, bum me out. I will say like it's a delicate balance because obviously I don't want to be so removed from what's going on that I am like ignorant, I guess, for lack of a better term, but I'm also mindful not to like fall into a vortex of, you know, watching or seeing certain things if I know it's really going to mess with me. And so I say this because I am a person that wants to be aware of what everybody experiences. I was following so many different groups of people. So people with disabilities, people that are African American, people that are Asian, people that are white, people that are Middle Eastern, you name it, I was following them. So I found like after a while, because everybody, unfortunately, every group of person had something going on. It was just, as an empathic person, it was a lot to take in all the time. Everybody has a think piece. Everybody has something, right? So I had to learn how to balance. I want to know what's going on with this is too much, right? Especially as a therapist who's also sitting with people's stuff every day and also taking in a lot of that. So I had to figure out that balance. And so for everybody, that looks a little bit different, but I think it's important to figure out what it looks like to limit social media or just limit that content in general. Other things I'll do is I'll try to do at least something fun, like one thing that's fun every week. So if it's going to a museum, going to see a movie, hanging out with a friend, I'll try to do that. I connect with my therapist weekly and connect with close friends weekly, especially close friends that know me very well. I find that is very rejuvenating for me, even though I know I'm an introvert as well. I do like my alone time, but I think it's also good for me to connect with people that know me very well. So I try to do that. And then the therapist thing, I think it's just nice sometimes to have somebody that's completely removed from what's going on in your life and can just check in with you, and you can have a open space to say whatever. So that's been very freeing and helpful for me. Listening to music, watching plays and musicals, those are also fun for me. That's been something that I've been challenging myself to do a lot more of, actually, because I really love the arts in general. So I love just being able to have new experiences through that and learn about a new play and just, you know, do something different every once in a while, right? Last thing I've been trying to do too, or sorry, second to last thing, travel and just try new things with friends. So I know one of the things that I made as a goal this year was to at least visit, I think, 2 cities, and I've already done that, but with friends, and just try something different with them. So, but past things have looked like I went to a drag show with a friend. That was something new that I never did. I went hiking with another friend. That was something new I never had done before. Rock climbing with a friend. So I've been trying to incorporate new things. Some of those things I'm like, oof, I don't know if I'll ever do this again. But it was something that I was like, hey, I've never done this before. This gives me an opportunity to check something out off of my list, but also kind of remove myself from my situation and do something for myself, right? And then the last thing is boundaries. I know this one is very, very hard for all of us, but I think we can all think of like a person, whether it's in our family, our friends, whatever, that sometimes they may not be the healthiest person for us. And so just being mindful of like how those people affect us can be very good for our self-care and very good for our mental health. So I try to practice that. So if there's certain people or situations that put me in a really bad mood, if I don't have to be around them very often, I try not to be. Unfortunately, sometimes that can even include family. So if there's certain situations or events or things that I don't necessarily have to be at, I'll limit that. I know, especially for me as the oldest, it comes with a lot of expectation sometimes. So I had to recognize like this is a getting to the point where it's a lot for me and I need to take some steps back. So again, people may not always be excited about what you are choosing to do for your mental health or self-care. I know sometimes my family, I've had some people that within it that are very hesitant or have pushed back about mental health stuff. But at the end of the day, I had to tell myself, and we all have to tell ourselves, that we're not doing it for anybody else but ourselves. Because at the end of the day, we're the ones that have to look at ourselves in the mirror. We're the ones that have to deal with the consequence of not taking care of ourselves. And so being intentional about taking care of yourself is such a big part of survival, or just thriving in this economy, in this world. And so, again, this is my short list. And I know since I've made this list, there's way more I can add onto this for sure. But I just wanted to give you guys like a short list of ideas, so that if you yourself are like, hey, how can I start building my PF? You can start by maybe doing some things on that list, or maybe what I said gives you some ideas for some other things you could do. So with that said, I thank you all for tuning in to another exciting episode of Critical Reads, the podcast. I hope that you guys enjoyed this episode and learned from Dr. Walker and some of my experiences. I am looking forward to posting some new content soon. I have quite a surprise that we will have a co-host joining me soon. So I look forward to introducing him and having him on the podcast and doing some more episodes with him. So stay tuned. And in the meantime, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode, and I look forward to posting something up again soon. Thank you.